Have you been angry yet today? Second question, would you consider yourself an angry person? If you were to find a word to characterize yourself emotionally, what word would describe you best? Would it be angry, or jovial, or serious, somber? What would your answer be? Are you an angry person? Not always, someone say. How often? 10% of the time? 20% of the time? 30% maybe? 40%? About 50%? The last Saturday in the month is one of my favorite Saturdays. It's a great day. It's a day when the residents of Hudson can take all their stuff to the dump. So liberating. So freeing. All that stuff that I don't need that's cluttering up my shelves, I can take it and just take it away. Of course, you have to do that without your wife going through all those things that you're taking away. But you have. Paul said there's something we need to take to the dump. Need to get rid of. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. I need to put away anger. Talk to you today about anger management. Galatians chapter 5 and verse 20 is an interesting verse. It talks about all the works of the flesh. We read that, and it says, the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery and fornication and uncleanness and lewdness and idolatry and sorcery. And boy, we see those and we say, yes, that's horrible stuff. In fact, that's the kind of stuff that makes you mad. You know, it really just irks you when you see that kind of stuff going on in society. And we look at the last part of that, and we see things like murders and drunkenness and revelries and such like. And you say, yeah, those things are horrible sins. They're definitely works of the flesh. And we like that verse that says, you know, just as I told you in the past, and that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. But we conveniently stick, kind of do the Passover in that middle verse that says, hatred and contentions and jealousies and outbursts of wrath and selfish ambitions and dissensions and heresy. And right there in the middle, he calls something that people, a lot of times we have a very difficult time with, this anger problem, one of the works of the flesh. And it can get us in the same heap of trouble that some of those other things can get us into that we all would recognize readily as works of the flesh and meriting eternal condemnation. So I want us to think about for a few minutes today anger, and that because Paul said we need to put it away from us. And the positive thing is it can be done. That I want you to see that it can be something we can put away. But the first point is we do make a lot of excuses for ourselves. Excuses like things I've heard, I just lost my cool. Or I'm just kind of short-tempered. Or it's in my blood. Some people even say, well, she's a redhead. Or he's a redhead. You know, you ever heard that? I always wanted to find some kind of statistical analysis on that. I don't know. I kind of was always glad I wasn't a redhead, though, growing up, because I'd always hear that. Or I'm Irish. You ever heard the Irish? Inevitably, they'll have movies where you always have Irish people fighting. But the most popular excuse of all is, you make me so mad. You know, we credit our loss of temper to someone else. And I believe that's a lie. But think about, for a minute, what makes you mad. Have you ever said that? I'm sure I have. But what would you say that about? What makes you mad? Being tailgated while you're driving? Queue jumpers when they're standing in line? Not getting a reply when you ask a question of a stranger or colleague? Smokers who let their smoke drift in your direction? Non-smokers who fan their imaginary smoke as soon as you light it up? Web pages that take ages to download? Drivers who stick exactly to the speed limit? Boy, don't you hate to get my guys. Noisy children playing outside your home? Family members who are untidy? People who silently sulk in order to get their own way? People who speak to you in a patronizing manner? People who arrive late for a social meeting? Telephone ringing? Just a list of them. Probably what gets your goat may not be on this list, but we usually could probably make a list of things. You know, who is in control of my anger? Me. Who is in control of your anger? You. Who is in control of my response to a difficult situation? Really, I am. You know, no one can make me mad. In other words, no one can make me sin. That's your choice. I think about Genesis chapter 4, when God had a conversation with Cain about an issue. He and Abel both brought sacrifices to the Lord, but God was pleased with Abel's sacrifice, and He was not pleased with Cain's sacrifice. And God talked to him about that. He said, beginning in verse 3, He said, "It came about in the course of time, Cain brought an offering of the Lord through the ground. Then Abel brought his offering," down in verse 6. "So the Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you so angry?' Cain became very angry. His countenance fell," verse 5 says. He says, "Why are you so angry? And why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire is for you, but you must master it." God sort of told Cain that you are in possession of your anger, and it was up to him to master it. Master your emotions. You know, something outside of myself can tempt me, but giving into it is my own possession. It's what I decide. Leonardo da Vinci said, "One can have no smaller or greater mastery than mastery of oneself." I like that statement. Powerful, provoking statement. I want to say to you that the Bible opposes the idea that we sin because we inherit some sinful nature from Adam. Now, I would readily tell you that I use the New International Version sometime. I use various versions, and in some things it's really good. Some people would just condemn it because it is Calvinistic, has a slant to it. Those who translated that version had a Calvinistic slant, and they did translate things in the book of Romans to promote this idea of a sinful nature. And so you have to be really aware of that. It's one of the flaws of that particular version. And that idea has made almost a religion out of buck passing. Blame shifting. The Bible doesn't teach that that's the way you ought to be. The Bible teaches that Adam allowed sin into the world by a choice that he made. The fact that sin entered the world because of Adam does not mean that I have to be a partaker of it. I mean, think about that for just a minute. Let me ask you another question. What sin do I have to commit? I said, "I don't know, but you got to sin, because the Bible says everybody's going to be a sinner." Okay, but what sin do you have to commit? Do you have to commit adultery? So I said, "I haven't never done it before. I hope I don't." Well, do you have to commit murder? I said, probably nobody here would say, "Yeah, I did it. I had to." Do you have to commit drunkenness? What sin do you have to commit? Do you have to lie? Well, we might all say, "Well, we all have at one point," but did you have to do it? Could you have chosen otherwise? Do you have to commit the sin of anger, sinful anger. You have to do it. James chapter 1, verse 14 and 15. Look over there. James chapter 1, 14 and 15. Very practical book, wisdom, teaching us a lot about where the rubber hits the road, how to behave. And he says, but each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust or desire. And when lust is conceived or has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. What does that say? It says, one doesn't become a sinner until sin is committed. And the sin is committed by the person who gives in to his own desire. He gives in to a temptation, following his own desire rather than following the will of God. Somebody says, but I'm only human. I hear that in prayer sometimes. We're just, how do we say it? Weak and sinful creatures. Are we, when we say that, are we excusing ourselves? Are we giving ourselves license? Just think about that. I mean, we certainly are weak, and we certainly do sin, but are we giving ourselves license to sin when we say that? I wonder. Jesus was human. Did he have to sin? Did God give him a free ticket, free pass? Did he kind of inject him with some kind of special serum so he could resist all temptation? I don't think so. Certainly wouldn't be like we are. Wouldn't be able to say he seemed to sympathize with our weaknesses. We were born with a sinful nature. I want to say to you, the Bible does not teach that. We need to stop blaming Adam and anybody else for our sin. We alone are responsible for our actions. There are two sinful responses to anger. There may be more. You might have some more sinking up. But I wrote two down. There are the spewers and the stewers. One blows up. The other clams up. One expresses it. The other suppresses it. One explodes. One implodes. The spewer blows up. He says, the outburst of anger that we read about from Galatians 5. Probably includes things like physical violence, harsh words, yelling, disrespectful judgments against someone else. The stewers are more subtle. It's more subtle and deceptive for the person that's doing it, I think. You keep it inside. You bottle it up. You just stop talking to everybody or the person you're mad at. You stop interacting. Kind of crawl into your cave. Just go off to yourself. You kind of try to punish the other person by withdrawal, by taking away something that they need. Maybe your interaction, your approval. It's deceptive, I say, because you think that since you aren't blowing up, then you're under control. That's really not true, is it? What happens inside the person who's clamming up, and I can say this because I know this is probably my direction that I tend to go, is they keep the anger inside. You get filled with resentment. You get bitter. You may hold a grudge. And a lot of times, eventually, you do this explosion. You let it out. But a lot of times, that everything that God condemned back in 431, along with the anger, is included in that, what happens to the guy that clams up. Bitterness, hatred, resentment, those kind of things. Neither one of those, the spewer or the steward, neither one does it solve the problem. It always just magnifies it. Just makes it worse, doesn't it? When we do that, you create a bigger problem. Well, the Bible has a lot to say about anger. It's amazing to me when I thought about doing that, just how many verses deal with anger that's sinful. I'm going to ask you to go back to the Proverbs. Turn back there. We're just going to read through some. Don't have time to talk about all of them, but There's so many, but we'll just read through some of them. Go back to Proverbs, very thought-provoking. Start in chapter 10. Go back to chapter 10 and verse 19. I just wrote these down, so we're going to read through these real quick. Chapter 10 and verse 19. When there are many words, transgression is unavoidable, but he who restrains his lips is wise. Chapter 12 and verse 16. Chapter 12 and verse 16. A fool's anger is known at once, but a prudent man conceals dishonor. Chapter 14, verse 17. A quick-tempered man acts foolishly, and a man of evil devices is hated. Verse 29 of chapter 14. He who is slow to anger has great understanding, but he who is quick-tempered exalts folly. When I read those series of verses, it struck me how losing my temper is equated with foolishness. Did you notice that? How he equates the guy who loses his temper, quick temper, etc., with being foolish. I think that helps us with our misperception. That it is a misperception because we think that the anger kind of shows that you're tough. You're not somebody to be trifled with. Kind of intimidating. Even righteous. We don't even define it as righteous a lot of times. But when one is losing his cool, God says he's a fool. What God sees is the reality, not what you think you are. And we need to hear that. What God sees is the reality, not what we define ourselves as. So when I'm being tempted to lose my temper, I need to ask, do I want to act like a fool in response to a difficult situation? Let's look further. Proverbs chapter 15, verse 1. A gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. You put this to use, you'll find how true it is. It's amazing how quickly a simple disagreement can just plummet and become a full-blown argument because the two parties feel like they have to answer in a disrespectful way when someone makes a statement that's disrespectful to them. You know, one disrespectful comment deserves another. And off we go. And something very shallow, very simple, something that could be resolved and just simply it just can become a disaster because we don't respond properly to it. There are other Proverbs too, chapter 15 and verse 18. Look at that one. A hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but the slow to anger pacifies contention. Chapter 16 and verse 32. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than the one who captures a city. Think of all the strength it takes to commandeer an army to capture cities. And Paul, and the proverb writer, Solomon says, the one who can control his spirit is mightier than the one who can take the city. Powerful statement. Chapter 19 and verse 11. A man's discretion makes him slow to anger, and it is his glory to overlook a transgression. It's his glory to overlook. Many times when you can get overlook something, but the guy just has to grab every slight, every mistake, every error, and go after it with gusto. You get what you come to. You know? Verse 19, a man of great anger shall bear the penalty. For if you rescue him, you'll only have to do it again. 21:19, over there. 21:19. It is better to live in a desert land than with a contentious and angry woman. Now, being with angry people, whether it's men or women, is not a pleasant thing. So he's not just singling out women. I think probably proportionately you get more of these proverbs directed at the guys. But this one was directed at the the woman. Chapter 22, verse 24 and 25. Do not associate with a man given to anger, or go with a hot-tempered man, lest you learn his ways and find a snare for yourself. Do you have friends that have the tendency to lose their temper? He says, better stay clear of them, because you'll turn out to be just like them. You'll learn their ways. Chapter 27, over there, 27 and verse 3. A stone is heavy and sand is weighty, but the provocation of a fool is heavier than both of them. Provocation, causing a fool to get angry, is worse than, more heavy than both of those. Verse chapter 29, verse 8. Scorners set a city aflame, but wise men turn away anger. Chapter 29 and verse 11. A fool always loses his temper, but a wise man holds it back. I think there may be as much or more. I would probably argue there's more material in the Bible that's devoted to this than there is to drunkenness. You ever think about maybe why that is? Chapter 29 and verse 20. Do you see a man who is hasty in his words? There's more hope for a fool than for him. You know, that doesn't speak of anger, but it tells us about our words. And the more you talk, the more likely you're going to say something that you wish you hadn't. Verse 22, an angry man stirs up strife, and a hot-tempered man abounds in transgression. It's not too hard to see the link between many words and transgression and a hot-tempered man and transgression. And that was verse 22. And then the last one I wrote down, just verse chapter 30 and verse 33. He says that, for the churning of milk produces butter, and the pressing of a nose brings forth blood. So the churning of anger produces strife. That verse paints an interesting scene, doesn't it? In our minds. If you work on something long enough, then it's going to produce something. If you churn butter, milk long enough, you get butter. If you pound on somebody's nose long enough, you're going to get blood out of it. And if you churn your anger enough, you're going to get strife. You're going to get friction. You're going to get conflict. That's the selections. I had one more. I just put this in here. Ecclesiastes 7:9. He says, don't be eager in your heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools. Solomon added that one in Ecclesiastes. You know, there's a lot of material on warning us where the rubber hits the road about the dangers and the foolishness of anger. What's interesting is we really don't even need, you don't even need the Bible to know that. I mean, even people who aren't believers know these things. Here's a list of you. Albert Einstein, he said, the anger dwells in the bosom of fools. Where do you think you got that? Lawrence J. Peters, who has all these quotes, he said, speak when you're angry and you'll make the best speech you'll ever regret. Benjamin Franklin, anger is never without reason, but seldom a good one. George Jean Nathan said, no man can think clearly when his fists are clenched. I want to talk about that a little bit more in just a minute. Benjamin Franklin said, whatever is begun in anger ends in shame. You don't have to be a believer to know. These are common sense things. We know it. People who aren't Christians, they know better. They know the devastating results of that kind of uncontrolled spirit. Think about how many foolish things we do when we're angry. No man can think clearly when his fists are clenched. I don't know about you, but when I'm angry, I make terrible arguments. Some people are pretty good. I mean, they can get sharp. They're sharper the more angry they get. They can really land. I can't. My arguments become really dumb. Because you get irrational, you know? I have a couple of Bible examples. Do you remember these guys? Remember Balaam back in Numbers 22? You remember his story? He was a false prophet. Balak summoned him to come and curse the children of Israel. Of course, he takes him up on it because he saw he's going to make a lot of money out of it. He's planning to make some money. So he's on his way there. You know, God said, yeah, go ahead. You want to, then just go ahead. So he goes, and on his way, an angel appears before Balaam. and before the donkey, but he's invisible. And Balaam yet can't see him, but the donkey can. So the first thing, the donkey kind of runs off the road and into the field, and Balaam is really aggravated. So he beats on his donkey. Donkey comes, gets him back up on the road. Donkey's going down the road a little bit further, and an angel appears again. Balaam can't see him. Donkey can, and so he runs off into a stone wall on the side of the road and really hurts Balaam's foot. Balaam is really mad. So he starts beating on the donkey. And then he gets him back on the road, and he's going down further. And then the angel of the Lord appears a third time. And this time the donkey just sits down. And Balaam is just, he's just in a rage. So he's just beating on this donkey. And the donkey turns around and talks to it. Says, "Hey, I'm your servant. I've been serving you for all these years. Why are you doing this to me? Now what would you do if your donkey started talking to you? I would run away." But Balaam doesn't do that. He just starts talking back and has a conversation with an animal. I mean, we do some really ridiculous things when we're angry. Irrational kind of things. And the more angry we get, it seems like, you know, the more we exaggerate things. You know, the madder you get, the worse everybody else drives. You notice that? The madder you get, the longer those red lights last, seem to keep you waiting. The worse, the madder you get, the worse the officials call the game. The more angry you get, the more thoughtless your spouse is. The more clearly you see her flaws or his flaws, right? The more angry we get, the more clearly we see their flaws. How foolish we are and irrational when we get angry. And then there's this other guy, Naaman, 2 Kings chapter 5, his story. He was a very impressive, powerful man. He was a captain of the army in Syria, at least one of the captains in the army of Syria. And at least in some battle, they had taken some captives, and one of them was a little girl from Israel. And Naaman had one little issue, one little thing that worked against him. He was a leper, or at least in that day, a terminal disease. And the little girl says, "Hey, we back in Israel, we have a prophet, and I think he could probably help you out on that. I think he could help that out." So Naaman spares no expense, goes to the king, gets permission to go, packs up his entourage of people, riches, lots of money, and he heads over to Israel. And really just he comes to this guy's house willing to really pay him royally for his help. And Elisha's the prophet, and he didn't even come out of the house. He didn't even come out of the house. He sends some servant out. And he says, "What? Go down here to the Jordan River. We know the story. And dip in the river 7 times. And Naaman's just beside himself. He's furious. I mean, this guy did not even dignify me to come out and talk to me. And I've come all this way, and he won't even talk to me. And he sends a servant out. And besides that, he wants me to go dip in the Jordan River. That is a muddy river. It's horrible. Filthy. Polluted. There's so many other Jordan." He's outraged. So down in verse 11, Naaman was furious, he says. And he went away and he said, "Behold, I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leper." He had in his mind the way it should have been. And because it didn't happen the way he thought it should have happened, he was really angry. Fortunately, somebody else was seeing things a little more clearly than him. And you would think, from a practical standpoint, all the trouble you went through to get there, at least you should go and give it a try. But not him. He doesn't see that as an option. So it says that his servant says, are not the... looked at in verse 13. Well, verse 12 says he's arguing about these other rivers, and he said, "Could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned away and he went away in a rage. He just leaves, stomps off. You can almost imagine, come and see him, stomping away in a rage. Then his servant, verse 13, then his servants came near and spoke to him and said, "My father, had the prophet told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean?" Isn't it interesting that it occurred to everybody else but Naaman what he should do. Naaman is angry and he does the foolish thing. But the servant is rational and clear thinking, and he says, "Here's what you need to do. Here's the sensible thing to do." Unfortunately, we don't always have a servant nearby to help us think clearly when we're angry. Anger can cause us to do nearly anything. It dulls our senses. It blinds us. I didn't really understand what blind rage is or blindness. I was angry one time, and you can almost feel the mist kind of coming down over your eyes. Kind of get bleary-eyed, you know? You're so angry. Can't hardly see straight, you're so mad. And we do senseless, dumb things when we do that. And 99% of the time, it usually ends up being hurtful to somebody else. Usually it's taken out of somebody else. And, you know, the truth is, all anger is not wrong. In fact, if you get a concordance out and you go through the concordance and you try to find all the references to wrath and anger, who do you think they are most closely associated with? With God. Most of the time you find anger, it's the one's angry is God. And it's because he's contemplating man's sin, our rebellion. And we know the stories. We may think about when Jesus was angry with his conspirators. Remember when he healed a fellow that had palsy, his hand was all withered, and he heals him in the synagogue that day. and the other Jews who were around him, the leaders of the Pharisees, they probably brought the guy there to begin with, see if they could trip Jesus up, trap him. And Jesus heals this guy. And they go out and they're conspiring against him. Jesus is mad. It says he looks up with anger at them. He was furious with them. Or maybe you remember the other story where Jesus cleanses the temple. Certainly Jesus was zealous for the Lord. He was zealous for the Lord's house and the things of the Lord. And they had corrupted it. And so he drove the money changers out of the temple. I think it'd be fair to say Jesus was pretty angry with those people. So someone says, see, it's not a sin to be angry. It's not a sin to be angry. Well, that's true. Anger in and of itself is not wrong. Anger is an emotion that God created. Intrinsically, it is good. It has a proper expression. God made it. God exercised it. But do you administer it rightly? Try to think about the last time you were angry. About the last time you were really mad. Did you exercise your anger properly? You know, God always does. Did you? Aristotle said, anybody can become angry. That's easy. But to be angry with the right person and to the right degree and at the right time and for the right purpose and in the right way, that's not within everybody's power. It is not easy. That was a good statement, I thought. Made me think. And James said, well, before we go to this next point, James made a comment about that. James chapter 1 and verse 19, I believe that's why he probably advises us. James chapter 1 verse 19, this you know, my beloved brethren, but let everyone be quick to hear and slow to speak and slow to anger. For the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. So what does the wrath of man produce? Nothing good. Nothing good. Neither blowing up nor clamming up. Because that's James' advice. That's the wisdom of God. Slow to speak. Slow to anger. What about the cost of sinful anger? I want to close with this. I'll stop. Let me tell you about this guy I read about. So over 300 years ago, there was a fellow, a British physician. His name was John Hunter. And he had a very bad temper, notorious for his bad temper. And, not surprisingly, he suffered from a heart disorder called angina pectoris. And Hunter would often comment, he would say, my life is at the mercy of any scoundrel who chooses to put me in a passion. My life is at the mercy of any scoundrel who chooses to put me in a passion. Passion being anger. His comments proved prophetic, and during a meeting of the board of St. George's Hospital in London, he became involved in a heated argument and walked out and dropped dead. That's sad. And that can be one of the consequences of anger. There can be a lot of strain on the heart, physical maladies that come from someone who lets that control his life, led to this guy's physical death. But more serious consequence than that, right? Matthew chapter 12. That says, either make the tree good and its fruit good, or else make the tree bad and its fruit bad, for a tree is known by its fruit. You brood of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. A good man, out of the good treasure of his heart, brings forth good things. And an evil man, out of the evil treasure, brings forth evil things. But I say to you that for every idle word that men may speak, they will give an account of it in the day of judgment. For by your words you will be justified, and by your words you will be condemned. So there's a consequence that goes far beyond any kind of physical malady of anger. Often in anger we say things, and Jesus says, unless we are forgiven, it will cause us to be lost in eternity. Brothers, sisters, certainly the bulk of the material is against us fellas. Whatever you think you gain by cursing somebody out or saying destructive things, exercising your anger when you're mad about something or mad at somebody, it is not worth eternity in hell. It's just not worth it. We need to elevate this work of the flesh to a position that it needs to be elevated. We are fools if we pat ourselves on the back for saying, I don't get drunk, I don't commit adultery, you're not going to find me worshiping idols. Well, you know what? So what? You know, if we don't get control of our anger and learn that those things are as important to the Lord as these other things, then, you know, we face some difficult consequences in this life and some difficult consequences in the next life. So next week, now this is a two-parter. It's a two-parter. You should be glad and rejoice about that. I'm not going to go on past 30 minutes. Someone says, I want to overcome my anger problem. I believe any of us that have a good heart and recognize the challenge that we have would say, I want to get rid of that. I want to do away with that. I got to work on it. Can I? And the Bible says you can. That's the good news. The Bible says you can. He says, put it away. Take it to the dump. Get rid of it so it can be overcome. So next week, if you would let me continue this, we'll do one more lesson and work on maybe some of the suggestions of things that we can do to overcome this particular challenge that many people face. And it's real challenge even for Christians. Thank you for your patience in listening. Get your songbooks out and turn to the song that we have selected. And maybe this morning you've been thinking about becoming a Christian. It's a good time to do that. Being baptized for forgiveness of your sins. Confessing your faith in Jesus Christ and believing in Him. Putting your trust in Him that He would be the object of your faith. And then learning to walk like He did. Learning to walk like He did. I'm talking about a subject this morning that's about learning to walk like Jesus did. And that takes practice and time and God's strength. So if we can encourage you and invite you to become a Christian or to begin that journey of walking with Jesus, so we invite you to do that together while we stand and sing.